Welcome to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, where we explore people's stories and events in Central Iowa. I am Pat Schlarbaum, your reporter and host for today. Thank you for listening. The weather this week will be decidedly colder and a bit more like December. I know you've all been reveling in day upon day of Indian summer autumn's delight, yet there's a chance of rain and thunderstorms before 4 p.m., then a slight chance of rain this evening. Mostly cloudy with a temperature rising to near 62 by noon, then falling to around 52 during the remainder of the day. With the south wind of 14 to 19 miles per hour becoming west-southwest, 21 to 26 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 37 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 50%. And there's a chance of rain and snow before midnight. Mostly cloudy, then gradually becoming clear with a low around 24 degrees. Windy with a west-northwest wind of 22 to 30 with gusts as high as 41 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 30%. Little or no rain or snow accumulation is expected. Tuesday will be mostly sunny with a high near 33. Windy with a west-northwest wind up to 26 miles per hour with gusts as high as 37. And the rest of the week will display a lot of high 20s and low 30s. And here's an announcement of a water summit to discuss confinement animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, is coming to Ames Monday, December 18th, 6:30 p.m. to 8:30 at the Ames Municipal Building Auditorium at 515 Clark Avenue. That's in the old high school. Senator David Johnson has convened summits in Decorah and Cedar Rapids previously. Turnout has been phenomenal. A panel of concerned farmers, environmentalists, and conservationists will present their stories and views concerning upcoming legislation to improve the Master Matrix document that provides livestock producers the guidelines in citing their CAFOs, or their confinement animal feeding operations. Senator Johnson is the remaining legislator of 12. There were 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans that created the Master Matrix document in 2002. He is convinced that the antiquated guidelines are not providing adequate protection to Iowa's beautiful lands and waters. So hope to see you there December 18th, 6:30 to 8:30, for a water summit at the Ames City Building Auditorium. And here are current news stories covered by Gavin Aronson with Iowa Informer News. Abandoning their promise to carefully consider a massive tax reform bill, Iowa Republicans Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst joined all but one of their Senate colleagues to vote for the bill early Saturday morning after it was hastily rewritten behind closed doors. The controversial legislation, which contained barely legible handwritten changes, contains $1.5 trillion in tax cuts and would raise taxes on the lower and middle class and graduate students, likely making pursuing advanced degrees too expensive for many of them. The bill would also slash the corporate tax and put at risk millions of Americans' health care by eliminating the Affordable Care Act within individuals' mandate and opens up Alaska's pristine National Wildlife Refuge for mining and drilling. The rushed process violated several governing norms by not following the normal Senate order. The House has passed a separate tax bill in November, and the two legislative chambers will now likely hold a conference committee to hash out differences between the two before a vote to send it to the president's desk for final approval. And Scott Pruitt, the controversial climate change denier, administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, visited Nevada on Friday for an invite-only event held by a prominent local cattleman and GOP donor Bill Couser. At the event, which took place just a few miles from Dow DuPont's recently closed $225 million cellulosic ethanol plant, Pruitt discussed lowering federal cellulosic ethanol standards. He also advocated for greater natural resource extraction, arguing that true environmentalism does not mean that we should put up fences and not use our natural resources, but instead should use them to benefit our neighbors, our country, and the world. During his visit, Pruitt had lunch with Governor Kim Reynolds and Iowa Agriculture Secretary Bill Northey, who has been nominated by President Trump for a position at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. After a jury last Thursday acquitted an undocumented immigrant of murder in the shooting death of Kate Stanley in San Francisco, Congressman Steve King took to Twitter, fuming that the death of Americans at the hands of illegals continues. The immigrant, 45-year-old Garcia Zarat, had previously been deported 5 times before he fired a Sig Sauer 40-caliber handgun that killed the 32-year-old woman as she walked along a San Francisco pier with her father. He maintained that the shooting was accidental, but the case became a focal point for conservatives, including President Trump, who have promoted the myth that undocumented immigrants commit violent acts at a greater rate than U.S. citizens. "Sickening," King said in another tweet. "I will spare no effort to do my own killing of all amnesty in every form." An anti-immigration hardliner, King has previously made analogies to compare immigrants to livestock and dogs and has repeatedly promoted the views of closed border advocating European nationalists. Zarat was convicted of being a felon in possession of a firearm, and federal immigration officials have indicated that they will try to once again deport him. And that's our report from Gavin Aronson, who writes a weekly news roundup brought to you through the Iowa Informer, an alternative online news magazine based in Ames that covers state and local politics and culture. Read more at iowainformer.com. So hope you all had a chance to view the big moon the last few evenings. It's a super moon. Full moons are always special and bring out the best in people. For those of you that follow the Yankton Nation moons, we are enthralled with this being called the Grandmother's Moon. So according to Melissa Breyer, supermoons occur when a full moon happens during the perigee, the point in its orbit when it's closest to the Earth. The result can make the moon appear 14% larger and 30% brighter than other full moons. And it's sure been bright through the clouds this morning. While last year's supermoon was closest to the planet since 1948, this month's full moon has veered 16,500 miles closer than usual. The moon was completely full last evening, yet will look big for a few more days. The full moon is a gorgeous thing on its own, and anytime people are excited to look up and revel in the wonders of the sky, it is a win for nature. If the moon is a bit bigger and brighter, all the better. We are losing the nighttime sky, so consider this a rallying cry to not turn a blind eye heavenward. I know our southern horizon in Milford Township, east of Ames, has many nightlights at the energy plants on Lincoln Way, and those new entities have compromised our dark skies. Tonight's sky is not conducive to enjoying its radiance with the fact that it's going to be cloudy. But yet, take a moment to enjoy a fascinating companion to our earthbound needs and desires. The moon won't let you down, even if it's cloudy.
This is a song for any of the kids in the audience, or maybe just the young at heart. lives are going round and round, they're going way and coming back, up and down like the moon. Sometimes we lose, sometimes we win, yeah, life can be full or can get a little thin like the moon. The stars can twinkle, sun can melt, clouds drift away, but you wonder why you fell like the moon. 'Cause these stories of our lives are going round and round, they're going away and coming back, up and down like the moon. Like the moon. And ooh, I keep wondering, don't you keep wondering about the man in the moon? Man in the moon. Jumped on the fiddle. Cow had a dream and she jumped way over the moon. And the little dog laughed, it was a cartoon. The dish had a dream and she ran away with the spoon. Diddle diddle dumpling, my son John used to be here now, part of him is gone. But his spirit still shines like a diamond in the sky, beaming back his love on this moon and you and I. You and I. 'Cause these rhythms of our lives are going round and round, they're going way and coming back, up and down like the moon. Like the moon. The moon shining on you, moon shining on me, shining on you, shining on me. And though we're miles apart, you know we're close as can be, 'cause the moon's shining. Costa Rica, Idaho, moon keeps on shining wherever you go, beaming back a message, how our love grows, shining like a diamond, and everyone knows it's the moon, knows it's the moon. 'Cause these stories of our lives are going round and round, they're going way and coming back, up and down like the moon.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOY 89.1 FM, and I'm Pat Schlarbaum, your reporter and host for today. The first weekend in December initiates deer hunting in Iowa, where 60,000 hunters take to the woods. Lots of deer will be taken to keep their population at acceptable financial and political levels. Each deer taken will be field dressed or eviscerated, leaving the entrails and organs in the field for scavenging mammals and raptors. The hawks and eagles will scavenge those remains. If lead ammunition was used in the taking, there will be lead shards and pieces of lead in the remains because lead will fragment when it hits bone. Bald eagles, our national symbol, can die due to the lead in the remains. It only takes a speck of lead the size of a grain of rice to kill an eagle. Creative solution to this potential tragedy is to use alternative ammunition made of copper. The use of copper deer slugs is strongly encouraged, and areas managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are requiring non-lead deer slugs on their areas. Listen to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Refuge Manager Ed Britson discuss this innovative approach to keep eagles flying freely from this generation to the next and the next forever. Welcome to Local Talk, Ed Britton. Could you give us your title and refuge that you manage there on the Mississippi River, please?
I'm the Wildlife Refuge Manager for the Savannah District of the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge. This office covers the southern 80 miles of the refuge, which essentially is Davenport to Dubuque. So we manage a little over 64,000 acres along 80 miles of the river.
And do you recall when your first bald eagle nesting occurred in the refuge?
I'm sure there were probably records. We were established in 1924, so I'm sure there were earlier nesting records. You know, once the severe population decline came out of by the mid-1965, when there was only a few hundred nesting pair left, we have records dating back to 69. That was one of the first nests after that big decline. Now we're averaging a little over 300 nests a year.
Oh, it's a wonderful success story. Thank you for those efforts, Mr. Britton. And you're also involved with the study on lead and its effects on the bald eagles?
Yes. Okay. Each year, you know, people find dead eagles along the river, and we winter about 3,000 eagles along this section of the river. The refuge actually extends 261 miles through four states. So every year, people find dead eagles laying up and down the river. They typically call a conservation office. We go and pick the eagles up, put them in a freezer, and at the end of the year, when our freezer is full, we send them off to the National Eagle Repository in Denver, Colorado. And we had been working on several other contaminants projects back in 2011, and we had a full freezer full of eagles. And so we started talking about what possible projects we could do. And we figured if we've got a full freezer of eagles, other people also do. So we made a general broadcast call to Iowa DNR, Minnesota DNR, Wisconsin DNR, Illinois DNR, and asked them, do you have eagles in your freezer? If you do, would you please send them to us? So during that first request, we received 58 eagles. We did a necropsy on those. We sent their livers off to the National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin, who is the premier wildlife diagnostic testing laboratory for all federal agencies. The results came back fairly high with lead poisoning, so we sent out a second request and got another 110 eagles. So totally, we looked at 168 dead bald eagles. And in that, it came back that 48% of those looking at lead in the liver, the concentration, 48% had detectable concentrations of lead, and 21% of those came back with lethal levels of lead.
21%, so you feel that's a significant portion of that mortality of bald eagles?
You know, one in five of those that we found, these were randomly found up and down the river, so, you know, to us, even though eagle populations are increasing, you know, they're still a fraction of what they were historically. But it does raise a concern for us for long-term impacts upon the population.
Was there a ratio of immatures to adults that you recall from those original numbers?
There is, but I just don't remember offhand exactly what it was.
But it does afflict both immature and adults.
Yes, it did. And we didn't see any difference between males and females either.
And, of course, the 5 years to attain that sexual maturity is kind of where I was going with that. For our listeners' benefit, will there be any new... Do you have any proposals or new regulatory measures?
No, we don't. What we did, you know, we wanted to look to see where the source of lead could possibly be coming from. And so we considered several things. We considered landfills. You know, in this part of the Northwest Illinois, we have a lot of old historic lead mines.
Oh, sure.
So we wanted to look at that, but we began to focus on lead ammunition to see if we could find what the prevalence was for a pathway, an exposure pathway in lead ammunition. And we have a managed deer hunt on our Lost Mound unit of the refuge. During that hunt, for 2 years, we provided free copper slugs to hunters. We asked them to please shoot them. It's not a requirement, but please do. A total of 57 deer were killed, and out of those, 25, almost half, were shot with lead because it was a voluntary program. So we collected those, all the gut piles that were shot with lead. We froze them, and we took them to veterinary clinics and had them x-rayed. And what we found was that 36% of those gut piles that we collected had lead fragments in them. And as many as over 100 lead fragments per pile. So we started looking at the association. We put motion sensor cameras out in the field. We continually saw eagles hovering above the hunt area, hunting the hunt. You know, they were hunting for food in the hunt area. And knowing that during the wintertime, the rivers freeze, the waterways freeze, they change their feeding habits from fish to upland game. And since they primarily eat animal matter, we didn't see them going into landfills. We didn't see them going to the old historic mines, you know, picking up a piece of lead. So that's why we focused on lead ammunition and these small fragments that are embedded in discarded carcasses, in gut piles, or in deer that are fatally wounded but not retrieved. So we actually documented the eagles coming in and feeding. We documented that 36% of the 25 that we looked at had lead fragments in them. So we just completed 4 open houses. We completed in Thompson, Illinois, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, Winona, Minnesota, and La Crosse, Wisconsin. We just completed 2 weeks of open houses. And to bring in a public awareness about the issue and really to talk to hunters, to tell them the story, to encourage them to use non-lead ammunition, and for non-hunters that, you know, maybe they had a family member or a friend, or maybe they were a landowner that allowed hunting. And, you know, for them to repeat our story that what we saw is the exposure pathway and to encourage the use of non-lead ammunition.
So these overwintering bald eagles are scavenging on the offal or the gut pile of the deer, and you feel they are contracting that lead exposure through that medium of scavenging upon those gut piles?
We saw them feeding on the piles. We saw the lead fragments in there, and there's been many other studies. You know, we just had our study 2 years, or it actually underwent 14 months of peer review. Our first publication is now in the Journal of Fish and Wildlife Management and the Fish and Wildlife Services Journal. So we underwent peer review to look at all of this. We know that lead fragments were present in the offal. We know that eagles eat the offal. So to us, there was a exposure pathway definitely shown in the study.
And some of those predator-prey relationship, we normally don't consider our national symbol a predator, but it does scavenge on protein that animal matter
It becomes quite a scavenger in the wintertime. You figure the rivers are frozen, you know, there's often snow cover, and you know, we've talked to many hunters and many other folks that the other studies that have been done show that becomes a very primary food item, the offal piles, the gut piles, the discarded parts. You know, we see them on roadkill deer laying along the highway. We see eagles on them. So one of the things we went and looked to see, you know, how prevalent is eagles feeding on gut piles? I looked at the 2012-2013 deer harvest reports for the 4 states of Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Over 600 37,000 deer were killed with firearms in total in those four states, just with firearms. Mm-hmm. So if you look at how many gun piles are out there, you know, with possibly a third of them containing lead fragments, we hope that telling our story to hunters may reduce that, the amount of lead ammunition out there that's available to scavenging eagles and other wildlife. When we set up our motion cameras, we saw red-tailed hawks, crows, coyotes, raccoons, skunks. You know, there's a variety of scavengers out there that are eating these piles that are discarded.
Right, and as a surviving scavenger, once they receive a meal, chances are they're going to return to that opportunity, and that's kind of what they focus in on. That's what's available during the deer season in December and January.
And when you look at the size of these gut piles, I mean, we weighed them because, you know, we were freezing them then. I mean, they're anywhere from 15 to 50 pounds.
Oh.
You know, it's a huge pile of protein.
And your recent outreach was designed to encourage hunters to use the non-lethal types of ammunition, meaning copper.
It was to really tell our story. You know, hunters are conservationists. Most hunters are conservationists. And I've been giving this story for a year and a half. And just about after every program, someone comes up to me and says, you know, I just didn't know this. And so we hope just by telling the story and others, you know, continuing to tell our story, that hunters will take that sense of responsibility and to begin using non-lead ammunition.
And could you articulate for our listeners the argument that promoting or saying anything against lead is a means of taking the firearms from the hunters?
You know, hunters are so important. We have to have hunting. I mean, they are the primary revenue source for DNR programs, for federal programs, for whether it's wildlife research or wildlife management. The millions and millions of dollars they provide, but just from the standpoint of control of disease, control of populations, hunting has got to stay here. This is just something we have to have. So this is really looking at the health of scavengers, the health of bald eagle populations. We encourage hunting on the refuge. We're wide open to hunting all four states. And really, it's just telling the story of what we found. We were surprised by the results, but many other studies back up the same thing that we found. We're just trying to tell the story and say there's a better way of doing things, and it really has nothing to do with trying to reduce hunting or being anti-hunting.
A better way of doing things. That seems to be a good summation of your efforts. We want to express our appreciation to you, Mr. Britson, for all
Thank you.
Yes, for all the conservation measures that you're implementing in your refuges. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, some of the hunter, you know, lead is the traditional bullet. I mean, it's used by most hunters. You look at some of the shooting tests that are being done, and they're showing particularly copper, which is very popular. It's effective, even and potentially much more effective than lead. Because what happens when you shoot a lead bullet and it fragments, it loses velocity. And when you shoot something like a copper bullet, instead of fragmenting, it mushrooms and it tears a much bigger hole, particularly with deer. When we handed out the free copper ammunition to our hunters, 25% of them changed. It's kind of interesting. Out of the hunters during the 2 years, 25% of the hunters, we had 162 hunters in the 2 years, 25% were already shooting copper. 25% changed to copper because we gave it to them free, and about half of them were using lead. Those 25% that did change to copper had many comments about with one shot they were killing deer. And when we looked at the wounded but not retrieved rate, the hunters that were shooting lead were three times more likely to shoot more than once on those crippled deer. So I think from a ballistic standpoint, you know, as a hunter myself, if I know that one shot is more than likely going to kill that deer, particularly that monster buck that I've been looking for, in my mind as a hunter, that helps me knowing that the velocity and some of the shooting tests show that they're at least as good, if not better, than lead ammunition.
And thanks for those remarks, Ed. This is I'm confident that we'll be able to share your study with our listeners. They will become a voice for this transition to the alternatives to the lead deer slugs.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the things that I hear in the programs is the cost. And, You know, I've done a lot of market research because we've been doing this for 2 years, providing free to the hunters. And if you shoot the traditional lead bullet, it costs about $1 a slug. That's the soft point traditional one. Most guys now are shooting the high-performance lead that has a copper jacket and a lead core, and they're paying $2 to $4 a slug. If you buy copper, which is popular, you'll pay $2 to $4 a slug, depending. You know, if you wait till a week before the deer season, you'll pay $4 a slug. Mm. If you look for sales, you'll pay $2 a slug. But the overall cost of deer hunting, it's such a minimal when you figure it may be a dollar more a slug to use something that's much more effective. So there's some manufacturers out there now that only manufacture green bullets, non-lead bullets. You can get non-lead bullets in every single caliber that's out there now. So we're seeing parts of the military change to non-lead. We're seeing some of the federal agencies, the National Park Service has been going this direction for years. Our law enforcement now uses non-lead for dispatching of wildlife and when we have to dispatch them. So I think as we see more and more people convert to this, there'll be a larger availability. So hopefully folks will recognize that non-lead for future is the way as conservation just to do the right thing.
Very good. Thanks again, Ed. I'll sure look forward to catching up to you next time I'm over on the river.
Thank you for helping spread the word.
Yes, sir. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed.
Okay.
Good day.
Take care.
Okay, and just to share with you, while deer hunting proceeded in southern Iowa over the weekend, I was made aware of two gut piles, or the offal remains of the field-dressed deer. And sure enough, there was a large shadow cast upon the valley, and looking up into the sun, an immature eagle was spotted. After the deer is shot, eagles are learning to hunt for the remains of field-dressed deer. If the deer was taken using lead, there's a strong possibility there will be lead in the remains. And you have been listening to Local Talk on KHOY 89.1 FM. I'm your host for today, Pat Schlarbaum. And now let's hear from Brown Beatty Hansen from Ames City Council member for her monthly report. This is a recording with a discussion she has with our principal reporter, Dennis Hart. Dennis is actually speaking with her from
California
by phone.
Ronan, we have a number of important and, need I say, controversial issues on the table this week. And one of them is involving increased rates for parking meters in Ames. You know better than anybody else that the council just voted to establish higher meter rates next year. I understand they're going to be $1 an hour for two-hour rates, 75 cents an hour for 4 hours, 50 cents an hour for 10 hours. First question, why are these higher rates needed?
That is a good question. And you're right, parking meter rates are often a controversial topic, too. There are a couple of reasons. For one, the city of Ames has not changed its parking meter rates in a very long time. And we looked at similar-sized communities in Iowa, in our area, and we really found that we were pretty low in terms of what we were charging for parking. That matters in places, you know, especially as we're thinking about, say, campus town area. We do have that intermodal facility, which is very nice, holds a lot of cars, and it doesn't get used much because its rates are higher than those of the parking meters in the campus town area. So the thought being that, you know, we want to utilize that intermodal facility too, and so we need to consider how we make those rates more comparable so that people will use that facility.
City manager the other night indicated that the increased rates could bring in nearly $575,000 to the city. What will that extra money be used for, potentially?
A lot of it would be for maintenance of current city lots. We saw the overall value of all the lots that the city owns, And the value of all that property, you know, in terms of as a parking lot, it's over $8 million. So as you can imagine, there are a lot of renovation costs, and eventually parking lots need to be completely redone. And when we do that, of course, we do need to comply with the stormwater standards that the private industries have to comply with as well. So we do need to maintain a fairly robust fund in order to meet those maintenance and replacement needs, too. And so that was another reason that we really wanted to move in a direction of higher rates.
Let's clarify. The lots that are currently free, the ones behind the businesses on Main Street next to the railroad tracks, are they going to remain free?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is just for existing meters. So it's the meters that already exist, and we are going to work on a more tiered system, which I think we haven't seen in Ames before, but they certainly have in other places where the meters closest to shops are a little more expensive. And then as you move more towards the fringe of the parking area, the rates on those drop and the hour limits increase. And so, again, that's tiers the demand for parking. People who are maybe able to walk farther or prefer to do so can park a little farther away, pay a little more. And those who need prime spots will have to pay a little more for them, basically.
I'm pretty sure that a lot of downtown merchants are not going to be happy with this. It's going to cost more money to park in front of their stores. What do you tell them?
Oh, good question. Well, we do still have the free lots. I mean, we're not changing that. I would also say that there are many successful business districts in Iowa and across the country that don't have the level of parking we have in downtown. And so really, I think the more you can encourage a more pedestrian culture and a more multimodal transportation culture, I guess the less parking will matter, right? So the more people are walking, the more they're taking the bus, the more they're riding their bikes, then car parking becomes sort of decreasingly relevant. And we do see those trends happening with millennials, you know, young people today, and just in general, more people are choosing a more, I guess, you know, the pedestrian, the bicycle, the bus transportation, multimodal. People are going more in that direction, especially in Ames. So I think, you know, I would tell them hopefully that they don't see it impacting their business in a negative way.
Since we're talking about downtown, let me veer just a little bit. The city is in the very preliminary stages, apparently, of discussing with a developer or more than one developer a major mixed-use project on Lincoln Way.
Yeah.
The Ames Trib ran the story a couple of weeks ago. What can you tell us about this project, or is there anything at this point you can tell us?
Well, council has not gotten more information than was in that Tribune article, say, about what that might look like. I'm sure that we will be getting a report on that soon. But currently, we've gotten the same information, really, that was out in the public already, which is that, yeah, exactly, there's a developer interested in land acquisition in that area in order to build a big mixed-use development there.
Is there a concern on your part, or should the council be concerned that as this progresses, this is going to be a major potential, not just residential, but commercial project. What about the impact on Main Street businesses? How do you protect those businesses from what could be a serious financial incursion there?
Do you mean that that they should be worried about competition with those who might be?
I do.
Interesting. I'd want to look at that. My gut instinct is that making the district stronger and better traveled would be better for everyone. I would hope and I would think that having a big chunk of residents right there would be beneficial to Main Street businesses. And any commercial draw, too, I would hope would still bring people to the whole district. We do, you know, obviously we have the railroad tracks to contend with in terms of pedestrian traffic, and car traffic, ability to cross. We do hope to be able to come to some solution there, you know, maybe an overpass, pedestrian overpass or something over the tracks, too. That is really speculative, though, pretty far out. But we are thinking about that as well. But I would say a lot of residents in the area and more traffic, I would think that would be beneficial for everybody.
Well, that's one we're going to be following, I guess, over months and maybe a few years as well. This is not even to a stage where it's been presented anywhere officially.
Exactly. And I got to think it would take some time. You know, just the speed of bureaucracy itself, as I'm sure you're aware, can be a little slow. So, yeah, exactly. This will be one that we should keep an eye on. But it'll be, you know, we're talking years out yet, I think.
Well, you know, I can't have a conversation with you without bringing up the rental ordinance. And we've done this before. You and I have had these conversations on this broadcast before. For those who don't know, and everybody should know, the state has essentially done away with Ames's ability to regulate on the basis of unrelated family members, unrelated people to live in a unit. And so the city has until the end of the year to come up with something new. And from my perch, it has been an absolute, very confusing mess at the city council. I think you'd probably agree with proposals and counter proposals. So here we are. Mm-hmm. Where do we stand at this moment in terms of this process of creating a new rental ordinance?
All right. Good question. And you did mention we were going to talk about some controversial stuff. So I was ready for this one.
I did.
Basically, like you said, as of January 1st, we can no longer prohibit rental occupancy based on the three unrelated adults thing. So council has started staff in the process of coming up with an ordinance that will cover a couple measures to control rental occupancy. Basically, we said that you can have up to three people in a one or a two or a three bedroom house, as you have been able to do, right? So that is the way it is currently, three unrelated. So you can have three people, unrelated or not, in a one-bedroom, a two-bedroom, or a three-bedroom house. And then we said, basically, once you get bigger than three-bedroom house, you can have one person per bedroom in rental properties. They do have to have parking, off-street parking, available to them to count as a bedroom. And what else did we do? Those were the two big ones.
So am I correct in what I've read or my understanding that under this proposal, and again, it has not been formally introduced yet, you're going to have three readings of it, I presume, mm-hmm. in December, yep. up to five people now could be in a home.
Yes.
As opposed to three prior. Now, so my question would be, how does that make life better for people who live in those impacted neighborhoods around campus if they can have more people in a rental than they can have now?
It would make life better for folks who are looking to rent, basically. You know, you can split the cost among five people rather than what was before three. So it does, I think that is a win for affordable housing in a sense. So that's the benefit of allowing more people in a house.
What about in the neighborhood itself, though, for those longtime residents?
Well, I don't know that they see it as. I mean, they liked the three unrelated. You know, that was probably more of a control for them. I don't know that they will love any additional density, but I think we had to compromise in some ways, and I think this was acceptable to the neighborhood as a compromise.
One of the problems apparently with this is how one defines a bedroom.
Yeah.
Is a bedroom a kitchen with a bed in it? Is it a hallway with a bed in it? So how is this going to be defined?
Good question. So this is one we did talk about at council. Currently, the inspection staff will let really, any room, we'll use that term hesitantly, be defined as a bedroom as long as it meets certain criteria. So they have to have an exit, I think two methods of egress, actually. Within the bedroom, there has to be a smoke alarm in any, you know, rental bedroom. If you're in a basement, you have to have an egress window, of course. Those will still hold true. So in order to count something as a bedroom, you know, it'll need to be safe to sleep in, you know, have fire alarms and methods of exit in case of an emergency and things like that. What the SCAN neighborhood came with a proposal for council to consider, and they wanted us to follow the assessor's definition of a bedroom, which when the assessor is defining how many bedrooms a house has, it does define a bedroom based on whether or not it has a closet attached to it. We didn't go with that definition.
So it will not be legal for somebody to take a mattress and put it, for example, in a bathroom and claim that that is now a bedroom?
No, the bathroom, no, certainly. I mean, For one, I doubt that that's going to be likely. More likely would be people who are putting a bedroom in a den or maybe a three-season porch or, you know, a living room, something like that. That, as you know, as long, again, as long as it's got two exits and a fire alarm, or a, then we'd let them count that. But bathrooms, no. I mean, they're probably... That's probably not ever going to work out. Same with kitchens, you know. Rental inspection staff, I think, would have, you know, have some leeway to say, no, a kitchen's not safe. Obviously, there's equipment in there and, you know, things like that.
Are you confident the council can pull this all together by the end of the year?
The end of the year, technically, no, because we need to have three readings, and we haven't had the first yet, and... Next week is the last council meeting in December. So I would anticipate that we'll see the first reading of that ordinance at that December meeting, and then we'll do the subsequent readings. Again, I would expect we would do them in their regularly scheduled time frame, which would get us into January. But I can't imagine anybody's going to go try to stuff a bunch of people in a house just for the month of January until we get that ordinance passed.
Is there some kind of moratorium that's going to continue into January on new rentals or anything like this?
Yeah, the moratorium that we established, this has been several meetings ago, and I can't remember if we talked about it on the radio or not, but the moratorium we established goes until March or April, I think, 6 months from when we started it, which I think is April-ish. And that prohibits new rental permits in certain affected neighborhoods, so the areas near campus, the South Campus area neighborhood, Oak to Riverside. There's a few others, but those are the main ones.
Quick discussion here on something coming up. Mayor Campbell is about to retire.
Yes.
John Hala is going to become mayor in January. How important is the mayor in terms of setting the agenda for meetings, for setting the stage for running meetings? Talk about the importance of the mayoral role in the city council. Considering the mayor has no vote, what does the mayor really do?
Oh, I mean, I think even though the mayor doesn't have a vote, they certainly are. They're the chair of the meeting. And so I think they have some ability. You know, they certainly have an ability to share their opinion on topics or to speak on topics, and that can have, you know, that certainly can have an impact if someone is very passionate about a topic and speaks one way or another on it. So even though they don't have a vote, I think the mayor does have influence, certainly.
New city councilman coming on board as well. Do you see any change in terms of issues coming before the council in terms of another vote or another side of a vote? In other words, is David Martin going to radically change anything in the way the council acts on anything in the next weeks or months that you see?
Oh, to be honest, you know, I don't know. I think David strikes me as a very reasonable person who will listen, you know, to the issues as they come up. I doubt that he has his mind sort of preset on any agenda or anything like that. So it's hard to say, you know. I would say I don't know. I don't know that I see any drastic change. Hard to say. And I do wish them both luck. I'm excited for the new year to start, and it's a lot of work, but also very rewarding. And so I think, yeah, I just wish them both luck as we start out in that.
And what do you see after the new year? What do you see the council taking up next year, and what would you like it to be doing next year?
Oh, good question. Well, we do, you know, actually, it's good we bring this up. One of the unknown or underknown, maybe, things that we do is a goal-setting session every January. Once the new council member is sworn in and the mayor sworn in, we'll have a goal-setting session. And the results of that goal-setting session matter a lot in terms of what our priorities are for the year. And it gets very little attention. Almost no one attends. The past 2 years, I've been very surprised by that, how significant that meeting is and how little attention it gets. So that goal-setting session, we'll certainly know more after that. You know, I could guess what those topics will be sort of based on last year, but the highlights probably will be downtown redevelopment and the embarking on our new land use policy plan, which is now a comprehensive plan, so that'll be even bigger of an undertaking than it was before. The Healthy Life Center, that'll probably be a topic that we talk a lot about in 2018. So those are just some off the top of my head. But again, that goal-setting session is one that we should keep an eye on.
You bring up the Healthy Life Center. Estimates are, Keith Abraham has estimated, it could cost as much as $51 million.
Yeah.
Probably you don't have that in your pocket right now, and neither do I. Where could that money come from?
Oh, good question. Well, you know, a couple sources. We certainly would seek donors on a project of that scale, naming rights and things like that. You know, also a bond referendum. You know, I think it'll have to come to that. The citizens of Ames will have to eventually decide if they want to fund that project of this scale. I mean, it is a really neat project. It has a lot of potential to be just a neat partnership and collaboration and a really neat facility. But the price tag is steep, and I think that'll be a challenge.
With the school board putting a bond issue up at some point for the new high school, and that could cost $90 to $100 million, do you see the city trying to rush it to get it on the same ballot, or perhaps waiting until what happens after the bond vote for the school? How do you see that playing out?
Ooh, I have no idea. Again, just gut instinct. I would think probably you wouldn't want to do them at the same time, but that, I don't know, actually. Good question. Speaking of the Healthy Life Center, too, we do at least know now where we stand. I mean, we have a meeting coming up, hopefully in January, about that, where we'll meet with the partners who are all involved in dialogue. But we did learn that the school district sounds like they need to go their own direction, just in terms of how we financially contribute. So that we learned in November as well. Or I guess that was end of October.
Were you disappointed that it couldn't work out, the partnership between the city and the school, the district couldn't work out? Because it seemed like you both wanted somewhat the same thing, and yet there were differences. But
yeah,
Economically, it would have made some sense for the partnership to take place.
Right, yeah.
You guys to go together.
Yep. Unfortunately, it just didn't work out with financing methods. But I would say, yeah, it would have been nice to be able to partner with them. But I think we still will, certainly, you know, in whatever ways we can partner with them on sharing time, you know, depending on what facilities they end up with, too. I mean, I don't think it's the end of our partnership with them on that topic. Yeah, but it was a little, yeah, it was sad to have them leave the table, so to speak.
Well, I think we're out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you.
Coming in today, and the best of the holiday season to you.
Oh, thank you. You as well.
We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and I've been your reporter and host, Pat Schlarbaum. Thank you for listening. Earlier in the show, we heard from Ed Britson, a refuge manager for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and from Dennis Hart with Brown Beatty Hansen with the Ames City Council. Speaking of the Ames City Council, a water summit is planned for Monday, December 18th, 6:30 to 8:30 in the auditorium at 515 Clark Avenue in the Ames Old High School. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOY at 89.1 FM. Also remember that you can hear it online at khoyfm.org and find links to the guests and other information you heard during the program. KHOY is streaming live online at khoyfm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Harris, by Tom Richards and Al Harris, from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard Man in the Moon by the Big Blue Sky Band. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team, please. And remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOY meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOY is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.